On this week's episode of FPL 360, we recap a crazy game week 6. First up on the agenda, we got to talk about Manchester City. I was pretty confident in a 3-1 scoreline going into this match. And as it unfolded, City decided to score 5 goals in the first 18 minutes.
When you're talking about something that escalated quickly, that doesn't even begin to describe this game. Like, only one team came to play.
I was driving for the first 15 or so minutes of this match, and my phone, my Premier League app kept going off, and I thought there was like something wrong with my phone. Little did I realize that it was the 5 goals in the first 18 minutes. By scoring 5 goals in that span, they became the first club to ever go up 5-0 in a Premier League match that quick.
And to think that if it wasn't for some bad finishing by Sergio Aguero, it could have been worse.
Yeah, the 8-0 scoreline was City's biggest win in the Premier League. Some other interesting facts: Aguero became the first player to score in 7 consecutive Premier League appearances for the first time since Lukaku back in December 2015. And, I mean, of course, we got to talk about my boy KDB.
The fact that he's probably not only the best midfielder in the Premier League, but staking a claim as the best midfielder in the world.
Yeah, I was pleasantly rewarded for making him my captain. Very happy about that. Bernardo Silva added a hat-trick. Riyad Mahrez, just like KDB, tallied 2 assists and a goal. I mean, since there's not much to debate, since we already knew City was good and didn't really expect that Watford new manager bump to run that long, there was no Raheem Sterling. And with KDB and Aguero being more consistent so far this season, is Sterling's place as the go-to City asset under threat?
I wouldn't say so, because everyone's going to fall victim to Pep Roulette. Like, last City game, it was KDB. Aguero got his rest in Champions League and will likely end up coming off of the bench like he did in the first couple of games in the Premier League season sometime in the near future. Sterling's gonna play, and Sterling's still gonna score. So, like, if the only reason you're truly looking at transferring Sterling out of your team is because he didn't play in the demolition against Watford, that's not the right way to look at this.
I do think it's a little bit of an overreaction for him to be the most sold player so far ahead of their trip to Everton. Although, as someone who owns Sterling, I kind of want to get Aubameyang, and I'm not shedding KDB, not shedding Salah. I mean, does it make sense if you were looking to take a -4 to sell Sterling to get in Aubameyang?
If it's for Aubameyang, I'm more okay with doing it than if it's for Aguero.
Yeah, I'm personally on board with Aubameyang. I mean, they have United, Bournemouth at home, Sheffield away, Palace at home, Wolves home, through game week 11, and that run should be extremely fruitful for him. Looking at Aguero, I mean, he has 8 goals through 6 matches. How many goals do you think he's going to score this season?
There's not much standing in his way of scoring 30.
Yeah. What would you put the over under at for how many goals he scores this year?
25.
I think he could easily get at this rate. I mean, he'll probably miss some time through injury, but he seems nailed on for at least 20. I'd be surprised if he has less than 25. But the other thing too, Nicholas Otamendi had a huge week in Fantrax. He was the highest scoring defender. He posted 29.5 points. Obviously, we're not expecting City to win 8-0 every match. But what's your early outlook for the trip to Everton this weekend?
I could see that easily being a 3-1 because Everton's not looking great. They're not even close to City's level. I still think that Everton probably scores a goal in that one. But if you're looking at just one City defender specifically, it's probably Otamendi because with him being the only center back fit, there's no choice but to play him. He's going to be a threat on corners and if you're playing long balls out of the back, there's always a shot that something finds the back of the net.
What kind of value would you give him in Fantrax? Is he a defender one or defender two?
Because of yellow cards, I probably only give him defender two upside in Fantrax as opposed to being a true defender one.
Yeah, I agree there. I mean, I do think would you be trying to trade for him right now?
Not really, because after this past week, whoever owns Otamendi will likely demand a boatload.
I mean, with Everton, Wolves, Palace, Villa, Southampton in their next five, I could definitely see more clean sheets. But yeah, I mean, the time to trade for Otamendi would have been before this performance because now people are going to want peak value after his monster week. We should probably go to the Liverpool victory over Chelsea next. Klopp's side weathered a second half comeback to hold on and beat Frank Lampard's Chelsea 2-1. I'm more interested in your thoughts on Liverpool having a 5-point gap at the top of the table with seeing how pissed off City were playing this weekend. Do you think that's large enough for them to hold on? Or
Not even close.
what would be a safe gap?
When we get to the end of the season and the title winner has been decided.
On Chelsea, I mean, this is a new Chelsea under Lampard. I can't really see why people would be disappointed with that performance. Obviously, Emerson suffered a setback. He's probably going to be out until after the next break, which means Marcus Alonso's back in the equation. Abraham came back down to earth. He was held scoreless, and he came off a little bit early. Looking at Lampard's first six matches, what kind of a grade would you give Lampard's job?
A C plus. It's satisfactory, but nothing special. I part of the reason why I'm disappointed with this result is when you is number one, everyone knows that Chelsea are awful at defending set pieces, and this has to include Frank Lampard. And you still got distracted by Liverpool having movement in the box and hung your keeper out to dry. Not once, but twice. Like, little mistakes like that are unfortunately more on the coach than they are on the players because it's your job as the coach to get the players ready for these scenarios that you know are going to come.
Having Kurt Zouma come in off the bench, I know he's kind of been the center back out in the cold the last few matches. But looking at Christensen, like, do you think Zouma should be getting more minutes specifically because of, as you said, the struggles on conceding off set pieces?
I think overall the best defensive pairing is probably going to end up being Rüdiger and Tomori. The issue is I don't think that there's any semblance of a good defensive pairing in the options that Chelsea has.
I mean, having N'Golo Kanté back was always going to be a plus. He scored probably, I don't know, where would you, I'd say it's probably one of his better goals.
I still don't know how that goal happened. Just one second he had the ball, and the next thing I knew he was lashing it into the back of the net.
I guess I was expecting the scoreline to be more lopsided for Liverpool, and I'm starting to wonder whether Chelsea's going to have enough steam this season. I mean, with guys like Mount and Abraham being the center of their attack, and obviously they don't have, you know, as much experience in the top flight, let alone holding up throughout a season. Should Chelsea fans be a little bit worried that they might run out of gas?
Not really, because they're gonna have enough room to rotate for the most part, that even when players start to tire, they'll have options that are just about as good, especially since Frank Lampard has been stating after every game that he wants to play Michy Batshuayi more. So this team has options, and even in that game, I thought that they were pretty sluggish in the first half, but then they grew into the game and were pressuring Liverpool more in the second half.
Yeah, I mean, Chelsea did have more possession overall. It was 55 to 45 after Liverpool got off to that good start. In terms to bring it back to fantasy, with Emerson out, are you thinking about potentially Alonso in FPL? As someone who owns Emerson, I was considering maybe making that move. The only thing standing in my way is that Alonso's at 6.2 and Emerson's at 5.5.
Yeah, the tough thing, number one, is the price tag. Number two is the fact that the reason why Alonso was able to do well in his last cameo was because Frank Lampard changed the entire system to a back three to accommodate him. With N'Golo Kanté back, I'm not sure that Lampard can or wants to do that, because Chelsea has so many attacking players that most games they're going to want to line up in a 4-3-3.
I mean, they have Brighton, Southampton, Newcastle, Burnley, Watford, Crystal Palace in their next six matches. So I could see him potentially tweaking the formation, maybe using three at the back, building up to that match at Manchester City in November. But I do agree. I think with Kanté back, it's a little harder to see them going to three at the back. And I was disappointed to see no minutes for Christian Pulisic. I'm guessing he's just further down on the depth chart at this point. But what do you think it's going to take for him to get back in the team? Is it maybe just a dip in form from Willian, or is there maybe more at play?
I mean, Willian already hasn't been playing well, so I think it's a little bit more than a dip in form for Willian. I don't really know what it's going to take for Pulisic to play, which sucks because he was being drafted in like the fourth round in Fantrax leagues, and like he's too valuable in a 10-team league and above to drop him to free agency. But like at the end of the day, if he's not bringing anything to your team, sooner or later you're gonna have to move him out because injuries are already starting to catch up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not thinking about getting rid of him in the places I've drafted him, and that has everything to do with the schedule coming up. I mean, I think if he does get back in the team, he won't have an issue performing towards where he was projected, where he's was drafted. But then again, that's going to come down to how Lampard handles the squad. But overall, I wouldn't be too nervous just yet.
I guess I should ask, at what point do you become concerned enough to drop Pulisic?
I would probably try and package him in a trade before I dropped him.
But he has no trade value.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if you're doing a 2-for-1. But I would be concerned if he doesn't get at least one. If he doesn't start against Brighton, Southampton, or Newcastle, I would be very concerned. Because at this point, you would think, okay, he needs to have a chance to get back in Lampard's good graces, if that's what it is. And I don't think you'll get a more appealing run than those three. But either way, the schedule is favorable, so I do think he'll come good. I do think he'll get back in the team. Obviously, tempering the expectations, I'm a little surprised that he played so much in the beginning and now he's not. I thought it was going to be the other way around. So I still wouldn't be too worried. If you're in a keeper league, though, I would look to trade for Pulisic because his value is not going to get much lower.
Oh yeah, in a keeper league, he still has insane value.
A club that, in my opinion, has absolutely no value after this week is Manchester United. Looking at Ole's record after winning first 9 away matches in his reign, they've failed to win any of the last 9. But the biggest issue for me is the defense. No clean sheets in their last 11 away games. That's the worst run in 17 years.
Yeah, it's not great. It doesn't help that Marcus Rashford went down in this game, and isn't Mason Greenwood also out with a
Yeah.
knock at the moment?
He had tonsillitis.
And then Anthony Martial is still unavailable. Paul Pogba's still missing. Luke Shaw's returning to health. So like, you've got a lot of people on the treatment table for United. So I do believe that what's currently going on is a little bit worse than what it really is and what it's gonna be for United. It's just this period is making their players almost unusable without Pogba, Shaw, and Martial around.
Yeah, the injuries are starting to add up. I think it's more so a matter of I was expecting a regression this season. I didn't think we would have this many issues at the back, but it just comes down to as much as I think getting rid of Lukaku and Sanchez were both good moves, having a young team and no depth up front, I mean, you could just tell after Rashford went off. I mean, you have Lingard on essentially operating as a forward.
Yeah.
But even with Rashford in, though, there was like a lack of movement. It just doesn't really seem like there's a. Because they rely on creativity in the final third from Rashford and
Well,
Martial and Pogba to pick passes, it just seems like no one else knows what to do when they're not out there.
yeah, I mean, and you're gonna have a lack of movement when your midfield three is Matic, McTominay, and Juan Mata.
I actually turned the game off in the. I've never done this before. I actually turned the game off when they brought on Gomez in the 80th. I was like, I can't watch any more of this.
I mean, at that point, you're just kind of like, well, what are we gonna do?
And I thought it was an overreaction, and I turned it on five, turned it back on 5 minutes later, went outside, collected myself, and literally saw the foul and then Cresswell's free kick, and then proceeded to turn it off again.
Should we talk about how United was shut down and that it was a very well done performance by West Ham?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the Hammers deserved to win. I wasn't. I guess the other issue I'm having is. I thought West Ham played well, but I don't think they were. This was more, in my opinion, of just a letdown from United. I'm not trying to slight West Ham because I thought they did deserve all 3 points, but I just it just didn't I just did not sit well. I felt like I was watching a mid-table team.
Well, United
I
are a
know,
mid
they
table.
are. We are the mid-table team. But yeah, look, on West Ham, they've been extremely good defensively of late. They've now kept three straight clean sheets. They've only conceded twice since the opening day defeat against City. They didn't have Arthur Masuaku. Aaron Cresswell came in. He looked like the left back from a couple of years ago, scored a great free kick. Are they a potential source of clean sheets from a sustainability point in FPL?
Sustainability and West Ham are still not words that I'm ready to use in the same sentence. Are they becoming a better defensive unit to think about bringing in their options? Yes. I'm just still not ready to trust a West Ham defensive option.
Yeah, they have Bournemouth, Palace, Everton, Sheffield, Newcastle, Burnley in their next six.
I am still 100% backing their back three, even though Sebastian Haller was shut down by Manchester United. But to be fair, he was going up against center backs that play to negate his skill set of bringing the ball down. And his hold-up play was still extremely important in that game.
Yeah, no, I mean he did the thing with Haller is he does exactly what you need out of a target forward. So even the matches where he hasn't scored that well in fantasy or he hasn't gotten on the board, I mean even in his debut against Man City, there was four or five sequences where he just did excellent to hold up the ball, kind of got that here again. I think with him moving forward, I'm cautiously optimistic for West Ham, but at the same time, I feel like every time they start to look like the club they should be on paper, we do have a letdown. So, should we be worried with them facing the Cherries this week?
Well, the thing is, we had the letdown before the Manchester United game, and this game was the response because the letdown was Aston Villa.
I'm interested to get your take on this too. I mean, Arthur Masuaku was in really good form prior to getting his one match ban. And with Cresswell coming back, looking solid in defense, obviously we know about his set piece abilities. Do you see this being a 50-50 position battle moving forward, or is Masuaku still the clear-cut first choice left back?
I'm not sure. I think that if Len as long as Lanzini is out, Cresswell should be the number one left back due to the fact that with Lanzini out, you need someone on set pieces, and Felipe Anderson hasn't shown that he's consistent enough to be able to take the lion's share of them. And Cresswell can, while still being just as good as Masuaku defensively. He's just not as good going forward. But, like, you don't really have to be with Felipe Anderson rounding into form and Yarmolenko also darting across the field.
Yeah, having Yarmo in form, goals in each of his last two matches, I do agree with Lanzini out. The difference, excuse me, with Cresswell, obviously you have better distribution from the wing than Masuaku, but he's a completely different left back. Masuaku, obviously, the overlapping runs he provides with his pace combining with Anderson has been key early. And by bringing more of a traditional left back in, you kind of change the shape of that attack. But it's more fluid right now with Fornals in there for Lanzini and having Noble and Rice kind of sit deeper. So that's be interesting. It's something worth monitoring, though, because I do think Cresswell has good streaming value when he plays. And I think with the slate coming up for them outside of the match against. Honestly, not
They
with the way
don't,
everything
yeah.
looks.
West Ham doesn't really have a bad match, at least for the offense,
I mean, the.
until
Yeah.
Liverpool.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is something to consider there. But on Yarmo, I transferred him out for Buendia last week. It looks like I acted too soon.
It's funny because I'm now thinking about transferring Lanzini out for Yarmo.
I mean, at 5.9 right now, that's a great price for what he's been doing. I guess the only concern I have, and this is kind of what fueled me transferring him out, even though he has 2 goals in his last 3 matches, he's only played more than 80 minutes once, and that was this past week against United.
But also it's like, and what's weird is I don't think Pellegrini wants his wings to play that much, because I'm pretty sure wasn't this like the third straight game that Anderson's got subbed out around the 70th minute as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was more tactical with them bringing in Wilshire, and then we did see. I mean, Yarmo didn't go off until the 89th for Snodgrass, but I do think that was more tactical. Looking at the last couple of matches for Anderson, he's gone 77, 87, 68, and 69. But I'm pretty sure he was
Well,
brought off against Villa
the 68 doesn't count because
through
that
red
was,
card.
yeah. I mean, overall, at the end of the day, they perform when they're on the field. As long as they're played the majority of the games and starting it. And for Yarmo, I 100% want Pellegrini to manage his minutes because I want him to stay healthy.
Yeah, with him coming off of pretty much missing most of last season, he was out, I think, from game week 6 or 7 through the rest of the year. So you can tell, kind of just cautiously working him back to full fitness. Shifting focus to Tottenham. I thought the match against Leicester could have gone either way. The decider was a nice late goal by James Maddison.
No, the decider was VAR ruling out a just offsides goal, which I know just offsides is offsides, but minuscule decisions.
Were you happy with Spurs' performance?
I haven't been happy with Spurs' performance in like a single game outside of Crystal Palace this season.
The big focus here is Dele Alli. He did play. Did he go the full 90 in the Champions League last week?
That's a good question. While I pull that up, I'm gonna say he wasn't the big disappointment. The big disappointment was Mauricio Pochettino.
Yeah, he celebrated his 250th match in charge of the Premier League with the defeat. I'm guessing this is something to do your disappointment with his selection, specifically the midfield.
Yes, that would be 100% my issue. Dele Alli did not go the full 90. When was he subbed off in this game? Because he
I
what?
want to say he must have came off around the 80th then.
Dele Alli came off in the 73rd minute.
I mean, I guess I'm not.
Also known as enough time to feature during the weekend. But Dele Alli not starting isn't really what concerns me. Like, I get trying to work him back to fitness because his hamstring issues have essentially become chronic at this point. My issue is why is Sissoko still playing so much time? And if you know that Christian Eriksen is still with this team, why are you not starting him in important away games like this one? And if you didn't plan to start Christian Eriksen in important away games like this one, why didn't you sell him?
Yeah, I don't understand that. I do get maybe they're apprehensive about bringing Dele Alli in like that, but not seeing him on the bench I thought was kind of odd. And the midfield of Lamela, Winks, Sissoko, and Ndombele, it just seems like kind of stupid that they wouldn't be starting Eriksen here.
Yeah, because your midfield in that way literally has Dembele and then two players that do the other one half of what he does.
On Eriksen, what is your thoughts for his rest of season value?
You're just going to be rolling the dice every week, and you're going to hope it comes up sixes.
Yeah, I don't. I'm expecting he gets sold in January. The way things are going,
I don't see. It's hard to see right now how he spends more time on this team, but also just like against Leicester, like the bench was just uninspiring. You've got two defensive midfielders, Eriksen and Lucas Moura, a youth midfielder, Ben Davies, and a youth goalkeeper. Like, you're not going to win many Premier League games with zero game changers coming off the bench like that.
I mean, having Sessegnon and Lo Celso hurt obviously doesn't help, because those would be two guys you'd expect to see, or I would have expected to see in a match like that. On Dele Alli, though, is he worth holding right now?
He is 100% worth holding. Because, number one, I can't see Lamella keeping up his form completely moving forward, because he's also an injury risk in his own right. Also, just if things keep going at the rate that they're going, Dele's either going to have to take one of those sizes of midfield diamond, or the formation's going to have to change into a formation that actually suits Dele playing as a winger.
I think Dele, once he comes back, is going to have a good season. I'm having a little trouble figuring out where I would, what kind of value I would slap on him for the rest of the year. I'm leaning towards, let's say he makes his next start, or you assume in maybe next week.
Yeah, I would like to assume that he starts the next game for Spurs. Or, I mean, honestly, considering how things have been going for him, I don't even mind him getting a fitness run out against Colchester for 60.
Yeah, they have Southampton, Brighton, and Watford in their next three. I mean, Spurs kind of have a back-and-forth schedule for the rest of the season, but I would say I'm pretty confident Dele would, from rest of the season, be a top 20 midfielder.
I've been putting him in midfielder like 2.5 range, just because of the fact that I don't know how many starts he's going to get.
Yeah, playing time obviously is the one issue there, but I don't expect him to disappoint when he comes back, and I think that he's kind of the guy that they need right now, with Eriksen kind of being in limbo. Looking at Everton, we've kind of mentioned them in a couple of the other matches. I don't know what's going on. I'm very confused. Silva's side has suffered defeats in three of their last four matches. What do you think the issue is?
There's a couple of issues. There's like...
So let me redefine that a little bit. Is it more so... Is the form due to maybe Silva's tactics and his selection, or is this maybe they're just underperforming?
It's a mixture of both, because yes, it's slightly down. It is down to the tactics and selection, because Marco Silva has never been a guy that really has a plan B. And when you're not really threatening against Sheffield United, there's going to be problems. It also just shows how much Everton's been missing Andre Gomes in the midfield, because Morgan Schneiderlin cannot cut it for this team. Fabian Delph can barely cut it for this team. Like, Everton needs a consistent midfielder. And they also need Gylfi Sigurdsson to turn back the clock and show what he's about.
I was confused after having seen them struggle up front with Moise Kean and Calvert-Lewin. After seeing Calvert-Lewin score and then be dropped to the bench from Wissaken. Also, we had Bernard get a start for Iwobi. I don't think Silva is setting the team up with their best.
He's not, because
attacking options.
I get that you want to work Wissaken into the lineup, but like, you don't drop your two players who were your only bright attacking spots in your last game for, realistically, I don't think Bernard should even be getting in games for Everton.
Iwobi came on in the 55th minute for him, and then seeing Sanctosin come on instead of Calvert-Lewin just really confused me.
I'm still trying to figure out what the hell kind of formation Everton ended this game in. Because it seemed like they went 4-2-4 when they just throwing on. Actually, it can't have been a 4-2-4 because they also took Coleman out. So
they
a 3-2-5.
They ended with Sanctosin, Walcott, Richarlison, Sigurdsson, Iwobi. And then it kind of seemed like everyone was sitting deep behind them.
It's like, what the hell are you doing? like, even if you're going to overrun Sheffield United, which you're not, because they, like, while they're a swashbuckling team, they're still a very organized defensive outfit. Like, that just was extremely ridiculous.
It seemed to me like Everton were set up in the only way possible for Sheffield United to frustrate them. Just with how they play compared to how Silva approached this match. I'm not worried that... I mean, there's also something to be said for the fact that Everton had 16 shots and Sheffield United had 2.
Yeah, but everyone puts up a bunch of shots on Sheffield United. Like, it's up to Everton as a team to make them count, and they didn't.
Do you think they're going to maybe go after a striker in January?
No, because they've already spent too much money to be able to do that. I think that they're going to stick with what they have, because you're going to hope that... Gambian, I believe that's how you pronounce it, ends up playing a part, because it does suck that literally they purchased him, he made his debut, and now he's out. And you're going to hope that Coleman looks like his old self, or he loses his spot soon, which Marco Silva should probably think about that. Unfortunately, he decided to name him the captain, which makes it a lot harder for him to lose a spot.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm still staying on Lucas. I'm not worried about him, even though he's gone back-to-back matches without a return. His attacking upside is just too good to ignore in FPL. They have City, Burnley, West Ham, Brighton, and Spurs in their next 5, followed by Southampton and Norwich. So I'm expecting... I actually don't know what to expect.
Does Marco Silva survive the next 5?
Well, we can count 1, 2, 3. Not going to beat City. I don't think they'll beat West Ham. Not going to beat Spurs. Burnley. If they don't beat 3 of Burnley, West Ham, Southampton, Norwich, I think he's fully in trouble. I don't know if he'll get sacked, but when you look at December,
so you're saying possibly sacked by Thanksgiving, possibly.
I think because they have Liverpool, Chelsea, United, and Arsenal in a row. In December, I don't know if they wanted to, if they could even sack him before then.
But you'd want to, so that if the new manager needed it, they have the full time leading up to the transfer window, right?
But who would they replace him with?
I don't know. Not my problem to think that far ahead.
Yeah, I think if they get if they drop
Okay, they on October 5th, they go to Turf Moor and they lose to Burnley.
No, I think he would get sacked if they go to Brighton and they lose. If they lose this city, if they lose this
That
team,
one's possible. Trossard might be back.
yeah. I think what it would take is a poor performance or a lopsided defeat against Brighton or Southampton.
Okay, so we are marking down on our calendars for, gosh, I just had to schedule up. October 26th.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what else they could do. I mean, like you said, they've kind of spent their money. I mean, they've invested in Silva, but with the way some of the other teams that are around them that they expect to be better than are performing, it's really hard for me to see him keeping his job for the rest of the season if it just they continue just to look uninspired and kind of lost in the final third, and that's something they didn't expect to have an issue with under Silva.
Yep.
Club that is in the polar opposite position of Everton is Bournemouth. They rattled off their second straight 3-1 victory. Their attack has looked significantly better since Eddie Howe installed Diogo Rico at left back and moved Joshua King to the left side of midfield, in turn bringing Dominic Solanke into the starting 11. If something I came across today, I was putting my column together. Over the last two matches, 61% of their chances created have come from the left flank. Now, with them looking great, there is a question over the uses of Ryan Fraser. Do you see him coming back into the team this weekend, or is he? Because I don't want to say he's out in the cold, but it is kind of odd he hasn't started the last two matches.
So, I love the fact that Bournemouth has gotten it back going. I love the fact that Callum Wilson is also the other striker with Aguero to have a return in every single game this season. But valuing this team is insane. You'd think that Ryan Fraser would play over Harry Wilson, but he hasn't been. And I don't know how strict Harry Wilson's loan stipulations are, but it's almost making it seem like he might be undroppable.
Yeah, it could be that. I mean, I guess the other thing is with King playing on the left side of midfield where Frazier would be playing, I don't know if he's. I'm pretty sure since he's kind of broken into the team, he's always been used exclusively on the left. And I mean, it's not like he's looked bad when he's come on. He's been effective. He had an assist off the bench two matches ago. I guess this could be something to do with Wilson's loan, though. I mean, I don't really see why else he
It's,
wouldn't be
I
on the
mean,
team.
it's the only thing I could really see. The problem is, like, I like Josh King better at striker than Dominic Solanke. But if Josh King has a better understanding with Diego Rico, and that's what's going to end up being Bournemouth's best attack, then yeah, it makes complete sense for Eddie Howe to play Josh King on the left. And it's things like that, which are why he's the coach and knows more about these players than that we do. But as someone who's supposed to value Ryan Fraser's what he does in fantasy, it makes it damn near impossible. Because if you have him in a draft league, you can't drop him. He's now untouchable in FPL, and you just don't know what to do. And also, looking even further forward, I don't know where the hell David Brooks is going to play.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting when he comes back. I guess for the immediate future, Diego Rico.
Yes.
He headlines my column this week.
All I have to say is yes.
Yeah. What kind of value would you slap on him in terms of like a waiver priority or free agent budget bidding?
I mean, you're using a relatively high tier waiver on him because of how thin defensive options are with upside. Bournemouth's schedule moving forward, we'll see them. Let's see.
I have it in front of me if you want me to read it off.
I have it. It's like, it's up and down, but considering that most of Diego Rico's returns come attacking as opposed to clean sheets anyway, it's still going to be pretty useful because they'll be at home to West Ham, away to Arsenal, home to Norwich, away to Watford, home to United.
Yeah, something too to consider with Rico. He, I guess by the numbers, has been the second corner taker, but with Fraser not starting, he's pretty much handled all of them until Fraser comes on the pitch. So there's added upside there too. And it's always positive to see someone, when they're putting up assists, have them be actual assists opposed to fantasy awarded ones. He got an assist, set up Callum Wilson 2 matches ago, and then he got an assist off the corner for Nathan Ake against Southampton. And the other guy too is Dominic Solanke. I know he hasn't done much, but after a second straight start, is he worth a scoop?
Nope. Dominic Solanke is going to need to actually score a goal, get some shots on target, literally do anything outside of just pestering a defense, which is the only thing he's been doing lately.
Looking at Arsenal, they held on with 10 men to beat Aston Villa. As we mentioned earlier, we're both looking at Aubameyang just with their run coming up. They have Manchester United, Bournemouth, Sheffield Palace, and Wolves. I think he is the premium forward to look at, but since obviously he's owned in draft leagues, is Callum Wilson maybe the most interesting Arsenal player with Maitland-Niles missing out against?
Wait, what? Did
sorry,
Callum still stuck
Chambers.
On Bournemouth?
Yeah, so damn it, that always happens. I meant Callum Chambers. Is Chambers on the menu to stream with Maitland-Niles missing out through a one-match ban and Arsenal facing a very beatable Manchester United in game week 7?
So, if he is, I'd one, you're definitely waiting for lineups. Two, I would hope that Callum Chambers actually plays in a back three as opposed to playing right back. Because I don't mind him at right back, but all of his points from the previous game were from him scoring an unexpected goal.
Yeah, having the thought of having him at right back with Sokratis, Luiz, and Kolasinac, I don't know who's going to do the defending.
I mean, he'll still be the only player defending, but it's going to be scary as hell. The interesting thing with all of these defensive issues for Arsenal, one player who has actually been worth owning is Bernd Leno.
Yeah, Leno had a good performance against Aston Villa. He had 7 saves. I guess them having a poor defense yet kind of does work in his favor. Looking at Fantrax, he only had 7 points this week because he did concede twice. But if you look at his last couple of matches, he had 7 saves against Villa, 8 against Watford, and 7 against Spurs. So he's been putting up around 9 points per match the last 3.
And points-wise, he is the number 4 keeper in all of Fantrax, behind Nick Pope, Lucas Fabianski, and Hugo Lloris.
Speaking of goalkeepers, I noticed that Aaron Ramsdale got an assist on Callum Wilson's goal.
Oh man, against Southampton. We love a keeper assist. That was the most ridiculous but great thing all at the same time.
Yeah, he put up 25 points thanks to the assist with six saves. I was watching that match on Friday when I filled in for AM's Players to Watch. I was dead set on Wilson getting a return, and it came. It was gifted, but I'm glad that that did hit. He's looked great, but it's hilarious whenever you see a keeper get an assist. Looking at FPL, I believe he was the highest scoring keeper yet with 10 points. So it's too bad he didn't keep a clean sheet because he would have had a monster day.
Yeah, but you're not going to complain on any week that you get a keeper assist.
Two questions before we wrap up this episode of FPL 360. One comes on Twitter. I'm not sure who asked this because I forgot to write it down.
That one was GD Bristles.
GD Bristles on Twitter. He wants to know, would you find it a viable strategy to stream defenders who are playing Newcastle, Sheffield United, Palace, and Brighton every week? And this is for Fantrax.
So the short answer is yes. I generally wouldn't include Brighton in that, though.
Yeah, I think I think looking at definitely Newcastle.
Sheffield's a very interesting case as well.
Yeah, Sheffield's in the middle. Crystal Palace are weird because if you look at them defensively, they haven't been bad outside of that defeat against Spurs. But, I mean, we always expected that to be a victory by multiple goals for them. And then when they played Wolves this weekend, they were very close to keeping a clean sheet. It took a 90th minute, fourth minute of added time goal from Wolves for them to be denied another one.
And like looking at Sheffield United, they've only been shut out once this year, and that's against Southampton in a game in which they were down to 10 men. Crystal Palace has been shut out Palace has been shut out three times. So they definitely go straight into the mix. Newcastle's only been shut out twice.
Yeah, I would say looking at in terms of teams I would be confident streaming defenders from right now.
Well, against, not from. That's the big thing.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Against, when Watford plays away, I mean, they've been bad. They have one goal. Norwich City has also struggled on the road. When I was looking at their numbers, pretty much all of Pookie's damage has come at home. I wouldn't put them down there, though. I do think they're looking a bit better, but I would say Newcastle, definitely. It depends.
I'd add Aston Villa into the mix, especially since... Yeah. They love playing in games involving cards. There's been a red card in three straight games involving Aston Villa.
Yeah, I would say Villa, Newcastle.
Honestly, Everton away.
Everton. I mean, Sheffield United does have five away goals, but they're averaging six shots per game on the road. But they're it's a little bit less clear cut.
They forced two own goals this season.
Yeah. Honestly, at this point, even Arsenal. On the road.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it's like basically mid-table sides on the road that aren't named Burnley.
The second question comes from Satish on Twitter. He wants to know when is the best time to wild card in FPL. I know this is something we've discussed a couple times. I already wild carded. I did that coming out of the international break. But I'm curious to get your opinion because I know you waited later than me.
Yeah, I am still holding my wild card, and I think it depends because I know originally he asked this question having already made his transfers for the week, and which he took a minus four. Which, if you've already taken a hit, then wild carding is not an option because you're stuck with that hit no matter what, even if you activate your wild card after taking it. I always try to wild card when I feel that I need to make more than five changes to my team. And recently, due to starting the season with Aguero and KDB in my team, I've just been slightly tinkering around them, and I'm trying to hold it as long as I can, which is realistically, I'm using my wild card as a get Salah in when I finally need to card.
Yeah, I wild carded because I was dead set on getting KDB in. And when I looked at the construction of my team, this was going into game week four. So, sorry, this is right before the international break. I played it because I didn't have any mobility in terms of how to get KDB in without having to blow up my team. So, my approach is usually unless there's a premium player that I want to get in, I try and wait. It worked out for me this week. I mean, I put up 86 points with Kapten and KDB, but I would suggest using the wild card kind of as a last resort. I mean, I waited, I think, pretty long to use mine last season, and then I looked at it injury wise. But I don't know. I think it's team to team, it's different. I don't think there's ever a perfect time to wild card.
Yeah, no, it's definitely 100% based on your team. Like I've thought about it multiple times and then just come out of it with, I realistically can't build a team that makes that many changes for mine, so I should just hold. And the longer you're able to hold your wild card, the larger advantage you have by keeping it because you'll be able to quickly move off of injuries and things involving big players where other teams around you in rank won't.
Yeah, that's another thing to consider too. I would say maybe if you're dealing with one of your premium players getting hurt, it's something to consider there. But I always get a little bit tentative when I'm going to do my wild card because I just get FOMO about shedding guys. For example, I got rid of Callum Wilson in my wild card and it's kind of burned me the last couple of weeks. So I would set a wild, if you're going to wild card, I would plan it out and then let it sit for a day before making it so you don't do anything too rash.
Yeah, I like that idea, especially considering that I've probably taken extra caution with making moves with my team this year, which has led to me discussing doing my wild card on this pod twice and not actually doing it yet.
We'll be following that closely. That's going to do it for this episode of FPL 360. We will be back later this week to preview the matches for Game Week 7. Remember, you can find us on Twitter at FPL_360 and pretty much everywhere podcasts are located on the internet.